Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us on a Sunday. Our guest today is Mr. Miles Coleman. He's the associate editor for Professor Larry Sabatow's Crystal Ball out at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. Good morning, sir.
Nice to be here.
And thank you for coming down. I invited you because out of everything that's happened over the last, I'll say, 8 to 12 years, many people would have a conversation about how the Republican Party has changed. And so the thought in my head was how the GOP has changed in the last few decades. From its foundation, is that the word for it? When you have your platform, how the platform has changed. And then I thought back, you can even go back a little further in history. Right. And so I reached out and I wanted someone who might know to come in and talk about that during the hour. And I found Mr. Miles Coleman to do that from the Center for Politics. And so that's our hour, is the change of the GOP in history. And then we'll come up and we'll spend a little bit more time on that in the more recent decades.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's kind of funny because tomorrow with the Iowa caucus is really the first big voting event in the Democratic primary, and you hear all these stories about, okay, what does the Democratic Party really want to be like? Should it go to the moderates, or should it go to a bit more left? But I think it's an equally important conversation to really look at the Republican Party, and because that's really the other half of the equation as to how we got here. So I think this is a pretty timely conversation as well.
Well, good. Let's start the conversation further back in time, because when I did my little bit of preparation, there used to be the Whigs. Let's start with the Whigs becoming the Republicans. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, sure. So basically, the Republican Party was founded in 1854 in Wisconsin as really an anti-slavery party. The Whigs were somewhat their predecessor. The Republican Party is a bit newer than the Democratic Party. The Democrats were mostly around since the time of Andrew Jackson in the 1820s. So up until that point, the Whigs were were the rival of the Republicans. And the Whigs had a number of internal divisions, making them kind of less viable. So the Republican Party was really founded as kind of a successor to the Whigs, more or less. Republican Party was founded in 1854, and it was pretty amazing, really, that just 6 years later they won the presidency with Abraham Lincoln. So really, it was at its core, it was a anti-slavery abolitionist party, and even in the Republican Party at that time, you had different degrees of, okay, how anti-slavery, anti-South do we need to be? But generally, yes, it was the successor to what the Whigs were.
So at the time, in the 1850s, the Republicans are anti-slavery. The Democrats are considered pro-slavery. But then sometime going forward, those thoughts and other foundations of each party, those two virtually switch.
Not
to say that today's Republicans are pro-slavery.
Right. Yeah, I think what you're kind of getting at there is it's more the coalitions than anything else, because back in the when Abraham Lincoln was elected in 1860, for example, his base was really the northern states, the Rust Belt, what we would call now. Those are the states that really put him into office, Abraham Lincoln, as a Republican, he wasn't even on the ballot in most states of the South, which were at the time solidly Democratic, really since the days of Jackson. And today it's different because, you know, we think of Virginia, for example, in the last presidential election in 2016. It was the only state that would have been in the old Confederacy that voted for Hillary Clinton. So the South is now, granted, there are some competitive states in that South, like Georgia, North Carolina, Florida. But the South is generally one of the regions that today gives the Republicans their best margins. So that there's been quite a transition there.
So how did that come to be?
Sure. So it's pretty interesting that the South was mostly Democratic until the New Deal. Ironically, FDR was really the last when he was reelected in 1944. He was the last Democratic presidential nominee to win the entire old Confederacy. There have been some who have been close since then. Jimmy Carter, for example, won every Southern state except for Virginia. So kind of the opposite of what we saw in 2016. But I think the messaging of the parties has kind of a lot to really deal with that Democrats since FDR have taken on more of a liberalism. The Republicans have, you know, kind of taken up the mantle of being the more conservative party, which plays well with, okay, well, most states in the South, they're majority white, and they kind of play to that base as famously when Richard Nixon ran for the presidency in the late 60s and early 70s, he would talk about his strategy was to win over whites in the South. And something we talk about at the presidential level something we talk about at the Center for Politics is eventually all voting kind of follows what you see at the presidential level. So Richard Nixon was the first really Republican to kind of make the South part of a national Republican coalition. The first time the South really voted Republican was in 1964. That year, Lyndon Johnson was up for, in 1963, he had just taken over for JFK. In 1964, he was running for the presidency in his own right. And I'm sure, as most political observers know, the 1964 election was a landslide. LBJ won with over 60% of the national popular vote, won most states, but that year he signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and for that reason, as a Democrat, he lost a number of states in the South, which traditionally he shouldn't have. His opponent that year, Barry Goldwater, was kind of the was the Republican nominee. His platform, he really emphasized states' rights, which the South kind of latched onto. And so that was the 64 election was really the first time that the South really started to vote noticeably Republican. But I would say it kind of all followed that. Of course, in the past decades, in the South, you couldn't really after the '60s, you really couldn't be, if you were a Republican running in the South, you really couldn't be try to openly court the white votes on using some of the racial language that we've seen in some of the past decades before that. But you would say, okay, well, my party is tough on crime. So they would use euphemisms like that to kind of win over whites in the South. And to an extent, that's where we still are.
Our guest today is Miles Coleman. He's the associate editor of Larry Sabatow's Crystal Ball at UVA's Center for Politics. You can find that at centerforpolitics.org/crystalball. Miles, so you talked about the Civil Rights Act, and we were talking about how the Republicans and the Democrats virtually switched what we think of them today. They virtually switched back in the 1930s?
I would say probably the 60s was really when the, with the LBJ Goldwater election, was the really, was the first time that at the presidential level, at least, where the Republicans had a critical mass of votes in the South. Now, there were some Democratic presidential nominees later, Jimmy Carter, for example, and Bill Clinton a bit later, who were able to kind of temporarily switch that back. Jimmy Carter won most of the South, but even Carter was a different type of Democrat than what we see today, because he's known for this today, is he regularly talks to us about his faith and his religion, and so that kind of played well in the South. That's something you normally see Republican candidates try to capitalize on. Bill Clinton, of course, being from the South himself, as a Democrat, he might have had some unique appeal there. But generally, with the 60s, the South started drifting Republican. And that's kind of the situation we find ourselves in, and kind of to this day.
So, again, the topic today, the change of the Republican Party. So, aside from the regions, the Republican Party going to the South part instead of the Rust Belt, and using euphemisms to make statements on their beliefs, let's talk about some of the things that remain the same and the differences between maybe the 60s and the current, since let's go to the 1980s and the into the current administration.
Sure.
So we know that we're now where the southern states remain Republican. And in the 1970s, we have Roe v. Wade. That's certainly becoming even more of a topic of conversation with the with what we have now in the court system.
Oh, yes.
Where, talk about that through the Republican Party. Have there been, or do you see any changes, or has that been something that remains the same on a standard train of thought?
No, it's actually that's just within really the past 10-ish years. That's on the issue of abortion specifically. At first, you know, the Roe v. Wade decision was in 1973. In the first election after that, in 1976, both Carter and Ford were both kind of waffly to some extent on the issue of abortion. And today it's become, you know, such a, if you're on, it's, it, generally, if you're Republican, you're against abortion rights. If you're a Democrat, you're for abortion rights. But that really has been something that's that kind of sorting has happened really within the past 10 years, because some of your listeners may recall back in 2009 where they were passing the Affordable Care Act, there was this congressman from Michigan. His name was Bart Stupak, and he tried to insert some language into the Affordable Care Act that would have banned certain funds from covering abortions. And there were some like 60 Democrats that signed on to his bill, and ultimately the bill didn't make it into the final Affordable Care Act. But Obama signed in one of their compromises. Obama signed an executive order, basically appeasing Stupak. And today there are only 3 or 4 at most the Democrats in the House that are pro-life, and if you look at the pro-life movement, it's more or less completely hitched its wagon to the Republican Party. So the differences we're seeing in abortion, it's like, okay, well, I feel like a decade ago, a pro-life Democrat would have been just as good as a pro-life Republican. Now it's not really that case. So I think on a lot of these cultural issues, the parties have sorted themselves into camps to a much greater extent than maybe in past decades.
What about the because I feel like this is certainly a part of the Roe v. Wade abortion issue. But I see that it's almost time to take our break, so I'll save this and come back to it. It is approaching 20 minutes after the hour. Our conversation today is the change of the Republican Party, its history, how it's done over the past decades. Specifically, as we're getting through time in the hour, we're going to talk about the 70s, the 80s, and through the last 2 decades. We'll take our first break. We'll come back, continue the conversation with Miles Coleman, the associate editor at Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball. Hang tight. And back in action here. Sunday morning wake-up call. Our guest today, Miles Coleman, as we're here for, talking politics at an appropriate time. Miles, we were talking about Roe v. Wade and abortion and how the Republican Party might have changed over decades, and we're saying about how Democrats had actually changed some over the past few decades. I was curious how the evangelicals had played a role in those parties. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Sure. Well, Richard Nixon was really the first to kind of court the evangelical vote when it really became sort of a crucial part of the Republican coalition that we see now was with Ronald Reagan. Famously, when he was speaking to an evangelical group in Dallas, he said, "Okay, well, I know you can't endorse me, but I endorse you." And ever since then, evangelicals have had a very important sway in Republican politics. In fact, kind of expanding a bit more. Reagan, when he ran, he would always his philosophy is he would talk about a three-legged stool. The first leg of that is really economic conservatism in the form of low taxes, deregulation, etc. The second leg of that was really a strong foreign policy. Back in Reagan's day, it meant really trying to win the Cold War, stick it to the USSR. But the third leg of that was really was really social conservatism as well, which is why he tried to bring in a lot of evangelical perspectives and leaders. In fact, I was watching before I came here, I was watching an interview of Reagan after his presidency, and he was like, "Well, they were asking him about his accomplishments, and one of the things he says, well, I helped to." I helped to restore faith in America. So ever since then, the evangelicals and the Christian right have kind of had a home in the Republican Party. It's catered to them on issues like abortion, whereas the Democrats, you know, they're just where the Democratic coalition is. If you ever read any of our articles at the Crystal Ball, what I'm kind of known for is a political mapper, and for me, this is what it all kind of goes back to. If you look at where the coalitions are, the Democrats tend to do better on the coast, where there's more of an elitism, maybe, maybe they're perceived as more of an elitist party that's more maybe cosmopolitan or transient. Whereas the Republicans have tried to play to those voters whose views are a bit more informed by religion, for example.
So you talk about the three-legged stool. So let's talk about these as a group. Because when I put together my list of things that are some things that remain the same and some things that are different for the Republican Party over the past four decades. I started with the 80s and went to current day. I had the goal of lowering taxes as the same, the goal of decreased regulation being the same, and But the Cold War for the Reagan administration would have been anti-Soviet issues. Mm-hmm. And here today, that's quite different.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's, I think, definitely thinking back to Reagan's three-legged stool compared to where we are, I think Trump may have sawed off a leg or two.
Well, I don't even know that the that today's Republican Party, as an entire group, agrees amongst itself.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, you have the president doing one thing, and I don't know that the rest of the GOP agrees with his thoughts and behaviors, but is just, I'll say, quietly allowing what's going on to happen.
Certainly. I think that definitely when Trump first ran, at least in 2016, there was a lot of resistance to him in the Republican Party. Maybe a perfect example of that was the National Review, which was a magazine founded in the 50s. So basically a long time publication where a lot of your top conservative minds would really get their information from. They came out against Trump because most of the stuff he was advocating for wasn't really your typical form of conservatism. You know, even when he was running, he was advocating for like tariffs. That's not, you know, that's not something that your typical fiscal conservative would be for. And you know, on the foreign policy front of that as well, Reagan, again, of course, was famous for calling the USSR the evil empire. And you see Trump today, kind of, okay, he won't say anything bad about Putin. So I think that, to a big degree, has really changed.
Again, our guest today is Miles Coleman from Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball at UVA's Center for Politics. We are talking about the changes of the Republican Party over time and history. Miles, you mentioned that your specialty and focus is mapping numbers.
Oh, yeah.
I'll ask you a question. This isn't specifically a map question, but mm-hmm. Demographics show that the Republican Party is aging, right? Is there thoughts that the Republican Party will pass on?
Sure.
Because it's mostly made up, at least demographics show that it's a large percentage of older white men. And every year or every number of years, that grows in time?
Sure. Well, I think for really since the Obama era, what the Democrats have talked about is, well, they're going to have this emerging coalition on the Democratic side of young people and minorities. Well, that's come about to some extent, but what I would say to that is, in a competitive two-party country, which we basically are now, the parties are always going to find ways to adapt. For example, I thought it was very interesting. I was doing some research before I came here, and in 1952, by that point, the Republicans had been locked out of the White House since for basically the last 20 years since FDR. And one of the things I saw some political analysts from that time in the 50s who were saying, well, the Republicans really have a problem reaching out to the reaching out to younger people. I'm like, wow, that sounds really familiar. And basically how they kind of got around that is, of course, in 1952, they nominated Eisenhower, who was a very popular president, and he kind of helped them get their mojo back to some extent. And what I found very fascinating too was the New York Times has this section. It's called the Upshot, and what they did a few years ago is they ran this story on how does the year of your birth affect your political preferences. And what they found was voters who were born in the early 40s, who had basically by that time they had come of age in the mid to late 50s when Eisenhower was president, he was popular. And political parties, to some extent, are like kind of Coke and Pepsi. Once you pick a brand, it's hard to kind of stop. And these voters who are now in their 70s. Came of age under Eisenhower. He kind of fostered very pro-Republican sentiments among that group. And sure enough, if you were born in the early 40s, you would most likely go on to vote for a Nixon or a Reagan. And the Republicans did very well with that age group. So I think going forward, yes, a lot of the Republican Party is older, but I think at the end of the day, the parties are going to always find ways to adapt. Kind of a similar example of that was that the in 1988. The Democrats thought that they had a really good chance to beat George H.W. Bush. They lost. But until Bill Clinton came along in 1992, the Republicans would talk about it's kind of the inverse of in the 2016 election where the Democrats would talk about, oh, well, we have what they call a blue wall. Most of these states in the Rust Belt that had voted Democrats since Bill Clinton. So basically, Trump won over a lot of those states. Well, in 1992, there are Republicans would talk about, okay, well, we have a red wall. These states have always voted Republican from 1968 to 1988. And some of the states in the Republicans' red wall were like California, Illinois, you know, states that we wouldn't really think of being as Republican today. But I think it just shows how the parties can kind of adapt, sort of from a policy, well, from really a messaging perspective. The Republicans famously did after Mitt Romney lost in 2012, they did this what they called an autopsy. Okay, well, basically the main takeaways from that were, okay, well, we need to be more competitive with Hispanics and minorities, etc. Kind of a perfect example of that is, well, I'm originally from Louisiana. Our governor at the time, Bobby Jindal, who was kind of different, he was an Indian American Republican, he kind of said, okay, well, basically the Republicans need to stop being a stupid party. And so, okay, so kind of post 2012, the party's prescription for itself was, okay, we need to reach out to Hispanics, minorities, be a bit more elevated. Donald Trump comes along and he does the complete opposite of that, and he wins. So yeah, I think some of the ways that these parties can ultimately put together a winning coalition can surprise people.
Again, our guest today, Miles Coleman from Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball, as we talk about the Republican Party, history, and some of the platform issues that remain the same over time and some of that are differences. One of the things that I found interesting is, going to turn into a question for you, is why would the percentage of Democrats with college degrees increase over the last 20 years, but the percentage of Republicans with college degrees remain the same?
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely a dynamic that we saw kind of before Trump came along, but since he's been kind of on the national stage, he's really that's a dynamic that he's really accelerated. Is basically Trump ran as kind of a populist. His message was basically made for the what we call the white working class, voters who might not have college degrees, tended to like his rhetoric more. A really fascinating poll I saw after the 2016 race was, which speaks to the coalitions that the parties have now. They asked voters about health care and amnesty. Voters who were against universal health care, I'm going to rephrase this. If you were against universal health care but for amnesty, so a lot of these voters would be wealthier. Compared to Obama, Clinton improved by 8 points with the voters who were for universal health care but against amnesty. Trump improved by 20. So it really speaks to the shifting coalitions, and I think a lot of that has to do with the messaging of the Republican Party, especially under Trump.
Amazing. Polls, they do so much. Let's take our next break. We will be back to continue the conversation. I want to come back. I want to talk a little bit more about some of the platform issues that have remained the same over time, some that have changed, and want to talk a little bit about how the current Republican Party might be represented in history going forward. Hang tight. And back in action here, Miles Coleman, our guest today. You can find his writing at centerforpolitics.org/crystalball. That's Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball at UVA's Center for Politics. What's it like working for Professor Sabato?
Oh, he's great. You definitely learn a lot about elections and politics. He's a great boss.
I know you weren't there at 2016, but I know that you work with others who were. Things change since the predictions for that election did not turn out properly?
Yeah, well, kind of hooking back into
the crystal ball was clouded.
Everyone really kind of messed up on that.
Not just Professor Sabato's crystal ball.
Everyone's wrong. In fact, one of my job interviews, one of the first one of the first questions he asked me was, okay, please tell me that you were wrong too in 2016. So it's like, yeah, we basically all were. Well, kind of what goes going with our discussion on education, you know, that being one of the biggest divides today in politics, I think one of the biggest lessons pollsters have taken out of the 2016 election is they really need to weigh some of their models by education. A perfect example of that was Georgia. We kind of think of being as a swing state. It was fairly close last time. It was Trump won it by 5 points. Every year, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution does a poll of Georgia, or every month, I'm sorry, does a poll of Georgia. They track stuff like Trump's approval, etc. So in November, they had a poll out where Trump's approval in Georgia, a state he won by 5 points, was at 44%, which, you know, isn't great. It's under 50, but when they released some of what we call their crosstabs, it looked like basically 60% of the people that they had interviewed had a college degree or higher, which we know Georgia, you know, it has a decent college-educated population, but not that high. So flash forward to in January, they did another poll of Trump's approval. They reweighted some of their demographics, and the percent of respondents with a college degree or higher was down to 35%, so it looked more like the state. And sure enough, Trump's approval was up 8 points, and it was over 50. So education has been, especially in the Trump era, that's one of the biggest divides that the party has seen. And kind of going back to what we were saying earlier about the religious right being such a big player in Republican politics, I saw a poll last year. Trump's approval with evangelicals was at 84, and to put that in perspective, George W. Bush, as much as he talked about his faith and how that informed his politics, George W. Bush's approval with evangelicals was only at 81%. So it's like, wow, Trump is doing even better than George W. Bush. Maybe not a result you'd expect given Trump's background, but I think it really speaks to the coalitions, again, that the parties have put together.
Let's talk about a similar topic for just a second.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Talk about the differences, the Republican Party, the differences over time.
Sure.
The traditionalism of the presidential office, because that's one thing that gets commented on frequently about the current president, is that he is not a traditional president in his behavior as a president. His verbiage, his behavior towards others, and in the past, however far you want to go back, whether you want to go back to President George W. Bush, whether you go back to President Reagan, you didn't see them publicly speak poorly of others in their party. You didn't see them speak poorly of opponents. You didn't see them You didn't see that sort of behavior. You didn't see that language. And this president has his others he's unhappy with, others he wants to join him in, you know, follow along. And if you don't, this is what you hear. And
well, I certainly with this president's attitude, and it's pretty obvious, like, more than anything else, he values loyalty to himself. I think a perfect example of what you're talking about, how there used to be with the presidential office this sense of, okay, it's a higher office, there's a certain sense of decorum. John McCain's funeral was a perfect example of that. There was a reason, you know, he wasn't a president, but McCain was certainly an elder statesman. You know, he was eulogized by Barack Obama and George W. Bush. So I think there was a message there that, okay, these people had competed with each other at the highest levels of politics, but at an event like this, at the end of the day, they're all going to come together for the good of the country and its institutions. Trump doesn't really go by that. There was a reason he wasn't invited. And kind of traditionally as well, looking to this next election, one of the things I say is, well, yeah, it's definitely going to be a close fought election, but you would think historically, given some of the indicators, like, for example, the economy is doing relatively well, we're not entangled in any massive foreign war, you would think the incumbent president would be cruising to reelection. And, you know, we say, okay, well, why isn't it going to be such a close race then? Well, look at the stuff that Trump tweets. That's basically why. You know, he tends to be somewhat of a loose cannon. He really marches to the beat of his own drum, and he's had a number of self-inflicted gaffes. So yeah, it'll be interesting. It really it helps Democrats in the sense that, you know, it kind of gives them an opening. But it'll be interesting to see. One of the other interesting data points that I came across was really on one of the things that really hasn't stayed the same over the course of the Republican Party. So as some of your listeners may remember, in 2016, Trump won in the Electoral College but lost the popular vote. There have only been four times in American history where there's basically been a misfire like that, where the winner of the popular vote wasn't the one who became president. And the other times it happened was in, of course, I'm sure everyone remembers, in 2000 with George W. Bush and Al Gore. But before that as well, in 1876 and 1888, it happened as well. And I thought it was interesting. All four of the times where the Electoral College vote has not matched a popular vote, the beneficiaries of it have been the Republicans. So I thought that was something that really hasn't changed.
Very interesting historical notes. Again, our guest today, Miles Goldman, associate editor, Larry Sabatow's Crystal Ball from UVA's Center for Politics. You can go and see his writing online at centerforpolitics.org/Crystal Ball. Only a little bit of time left. I'm curious as to where we've been talking about looking backwards to now. about looking now and going forwards and how the current Republican Party might be remembered in time. One of the things when I was making my notes, you made mention earlier talking about a poll and health care. And one of the things that I had written down was the Republican Party and their efforts at health care. And they were making efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act and put their own health care in, or not put their own health care in. Do you think that that's something that they'll be remembered for?
I mean, it's...
Or are there so many other things out there?
Well, I think that's,
that this will be an asterisk.
Well, I think that's certainly a big part of it, especially since the Affordable Care Act was passed. Such a central part of their imaging is we're going to repeal Obamacare. So I think that definitely when we're looking back at this era, the opposition to President Obama's health care law is definitely going to be seen as a key plank in their platform. But, you know, it's just been reinvented so much under Trump. It's going to be interesting to see where it ends up.
How about the, I mean, I think that the impeachment trial needs its own hour.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. But certainly the, what's been going on for the last, for this week, if we don't go further back, about the impeachment trial, the redefinition of executive and judicial powers. Do you think that what's going to happen once the trial is over, that executive powers will have been altered?
Well, I saw this interesting quote yesterday from John Meacham, who's a historian. He has a number of books out. He's known for, among other things, he's known for his biography of Andrew Jackson. He just did one on George H.W. Bush as well. But one of the things he said is Trump is functionally a monarch because his party is going to stick with him no matter what. So it's maybe not what the founders intended in terms of checks and balances and that type of stuff.
We continue to have another few. Every president, it seems to be a growing number of executive orders that are written. I don't want to make it sound like President Trump started executive orders.
Right.
We have another number of, at least a number of months left in the 11 months left minimal and this current administration. But the executive orders have been, executive branch has been changed, or
certainly
will be.
Certainly.
And the legislative branch will have been changed as well. And do you think that this has become, I'm curious as to, do you have an article upcoming about this?
No, but that definitely sounds something that sounds like something that we could explore. I mean, I really think part of this, you know, has to deal with the polarization we've seen in Washington, you know, I guess Obama, in his case, he also issued a fair number of executive orders. So you're right that it certainly wasn't new to Trump. But Obama had a Republican Congress for a lot of his presidency. So, you know, maybe I think it shows how partisan politics can really interfere with how our system is supposed to work.
My curiosity is, now that we have assuming that it ends on Wednesday, like is currently planned, and the conversation, if you don't read into the weeds, is that theoretically somewhere near 2/3 to 3/4 of our country did want to see witnesses come forward. And we always talk, and you're a specialist in mapping, where in the country is this? Did our 2/3 and 3/4 come from California, yeah, New York, et cetera? What's the percentage in Nebraska and Kansas and the southern states that typically vote for the current president?
That's a good point.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Coleman.
Oh,
Miles,
sure.
Coleman, the associate editor for Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate that very much. Everyone, thank you. Be here next week. Jennifer McKeever from Charlottesville's school board.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Engineering assistance was by Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.